And the Russian front smashed through any integrity that the Ukrainians could hold. So that conflict's effectively over, especially with Trump saying that he'll turn off the tap should he get elected. Yeah.
I don't know, man. I mean, you know, frankly, I think this could have been prevented long before. For Tricontinental, I wrote a newsletter documenting how in the months before February 2022, the Russians put a series of proposals to the Americans on the table saying, look, we need a security guarantee. There will be no U.S. nuclear mid-range missiles in Ukraine. There will be no joining NATO for Ukraine. These were security positions they wanted to negotiate. The U.S. just completely rejected all of them. The U.S. has become rejectionist when it feels like it. So, for instance, it was the U.S. that in 2019 withdrew from the Intermediate Forces Nuclear Treaty. You know, a hard-fought treaty to negotiate. You leave the INF Treaty in 2019, and then the Russians say, if you're not in the INF Treaty, we are afraid you're going to place missiles into Lithuania or into Ukraine. I mean, the Germans right now are building a military base. The Wehrmacht, same name, is building a military base in Lithuania for 4,000 German troops. You're going to see for the first time German troops deployed in a base outside Germany. German troops had been there supporting role in Afghanistan and so on. But they're going to be in a base in Lithuania on the Russian border. Now the fear is the Americans might use that base to place mid-range nuclear missiles. This is why Russia entered that conflict. It didn't enter the conflict necessarily to take land, you know, but now we're at a different period. Russia is probably not going to bargain away the Donbass region. You know, probably not. I don't know. It's likely that other territorial gains are part of the negotiation. Like they may give up Mariupol. I don't know. It's likely they want a land bridge to Crimea. You know, now it's too late. They've taken this territory. How are you going to bargain them down on that? I don't see it. I see a position now that unless the West pumps in more weapon systems into Ukraine, and which can really hit Russian targets, I think Ukraine is going to have to now live with this crescent from the Donbass down to Crimea in Russia, and then have integrity to hold the rest of the country of their own. Make concessions, no NATO, maybe they'll be allowed to join NATO, but no intermediate missiles. I don't know.
And how do we take a lesson from this in terms of Australia being now slowly over time positioned to almost affect a similar position towards China and Taiwan, where we will be the main buffer between an escalating tensions between America and China?
I mean, we are talking in Perth in Western Australia. Just south of us in Exmouth is a major communications and telecommunications base for submarines, but also they are planning for deep space. Just north of us, as you go up, there are submarine stations. Out maybe several hours to our west is Pine Gap, major radar installation, a part of the Five Eyes Triangle. Then you go north of there, Tyndall Air Base being expanded for B-52 and B-1 American nuclear bombers. Is this going to bring Australia safety? I mean, why do you want to put a target on your country? If the Americans decide to attack Beijing, if they put mid-range missiles in Taiwan and hit Beijing, you know, 8 minutes, 10 minutes flight time, the Chinese are going to hit Western Australia. And that means that you're going to go into a war with your closest ally. In terms of closest ally who? Not in terms of politics or military, but in terms of trade. That's your biggest trading partner. What's going to happen to the Australian economy? Do you think the Americans are going to win a war against China? The Americans can destroy a bunch of Chinese cities. That is their capability. But will they win a war against China? No way. And do you want a big missile to land somewhere in downtown Perth? No.
There'll be none left.
We don't want that. Nobody wants that. The Chinese don't want it. The Chinese don't want escalation. Why would Australia, makes no sense. Why would Australia want to antagonize its major trading partner? Why?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it comes this in lieu of a political class that is completely bereft of any morals or politics. There's no like neoliberal project or social democratic project. There's just this faceless lobbying of securing your private home in the beach, and that's about it.
What is that? I mean, you know, end of the day, yesterday, walking in parts of Perth, you see all these, the world's top number one and number two mineral and metals mining companies. BHP number one and Rio Tinto number two. They have a project. They have an agenda. They do 20-year planning. They know what's going on. They are not idiots. Yeah, it seems that they know what's going on. But the parliament, whether in Western Australia or in the federal parliament in Canberra, is not able to tell the people what its project is. These companies have a project. I mean, interestingly, one could only hope that these companies will see the unreason in some of these moves towards war. Like, will it benefit BHP and Rio Tinto for Australia to participate in a war with China? Is that going to be used? I don't think so. They're doing well as it is.
They're not going to be able to extract any more resources, or it'll affect their bottom line.
I mean, I don't know. I just think there's a level of illogic in this, you know, that the major class that is benefiting from extraction, how will a war increase your bottom line? You're already making enormous amounts of money. You're already in a pretty comfortable way. There's no challenge to you. There is really no Australian challenge to the kind of control that the Australian minerals and metals companies have and their subsidiaries.
There's only none. A mass capitulation, like, you know, here from a social perspective, mining companies, maybe some people might admit to their ills or something, but more or less it's viewed as like an escape scheme, you know, like do your time in the mines and then come back, buy your house, have a nice family, and that's it.
I'm not even thinking about the miners, man, because they have very few opportunities to resist. I'm thinking about society, you know, in general. I mean, the ancillaries, the this, the that. There seems to be no anti-mining, you know, I don't mean anti-mining. I mean, anti-mining company, you know, politics. So if you are a mining company, there's no threat to you. You are making money trading with China. Why would you want an escalation to war? That seems illogical to me. Now, okay, so forget my logic. There is an escalation to war. Is it merely that the people who work at the top of the mining companies have a sort of racist feeling that how dare China dictate the terms? We should be dictating the terms to them. You know, we executives of mining companies should be showing up in Beijing and they should be touching our feet, not the reverse. Maybe there's some of this racial politics involved, but how do I know? I have not yet had a chance to meet any of these executives. I welcome a discussion with any executive from a mining company. I would like to get to know them.
Mm-hmm. It's the minds of darkness there. So in that, like a Chinese cultural opposition, how do you view, like, I mean, in Australia particularly, it's been increasing this cynical care of the Xinjiang region and Uyghur genocide and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, there's some claims that were even leveled at you towards that. Question be twofold, like, okay, what would be a tangible way to critique Chinese internal policy if you even needed to? And then, like, what are the actual tangible effects of people absorbing this sort of propaganda uncritically?
I mean, look, firstly, I don't take instructions from governments like the Australian government. You know, they are running a concentration camp in Manaus Island for people who are trying to migrate here, working class people, climate refugees. The Australian government gives full support to its mining companies when they operate in Papua New Guinea or they operate in Africa, Latin America, and so on. I mean, I've done stories of these companies and the hideous crimes that they commit elsewhere to masses of population, displacement, extermination of people. I mean, we are sitting in Western Australia where the man who so-called discovered the northern part of this province, Mr. Forrest, exterminated native people who lived there. So, I mean, this country has no grounds to give any lectures to anybody about you know, treatment of people. I mean, where is the stolen generation's justice? You know, these people don't have a leg to stand on when it comes to morality. You know, they have an easy time criticizing other countries. What about here? I mean, I looked around and saw what is these kind of left formations in Australia so worried about Xinjiang. What have they been doing about the stolen generation? Children of the stolen generation are living on the streets in Sydney, in Melbourne, you know, in the northern parts of the country. They have no future in front of them. I met a man in Sydney. He's painting on the walls. I had a nice conversation with him. He told me, I'm from the stolen generation. I don't want us to be forgotten. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, write about me. You know, where are the people in Australia who are fighting for them? They are worried about Xinjiang. That's interesting. You can worry about Xinjiang, but first build your own house, you know, clean your own streets. Now, what is there in Xinjiang that is so upsetting you? The Chinese haven't done what, you know, the Americans did in Afghanistan or what the Russians did in Chechnya. They didn't come and just bomb Urumqi. In fact, Urumqi is unscathed. There was a series of bombings, terrorist actions in that part of the world led by people who now live in Idlib, Syria. They don't even live in Xinjiang province. And by the way, the name of the province is Xinjiang Uyghur province. So the Uyghurs are not being genocided. They're in the name of the province. It's true that they've taken out people who they think are overly radicalized by a certain form of Islam. They take them to these places. They basically give them an option to re-educate or get out of the country. And people have been there. They are studying whatever different ideas of Islam and so on. Now, I don't want to deal with a problem like that. I would prefer to have clean hands, you know. But this is a real problem the Chinese government has to face. People are blowing up civilian areas in the country. There is no mass sentiment for secession in that part of the world. What do you do? You know, do you just let people blow things up, go out there, preach all kinds of radical ideas? Or do you do something? They didn't want to kill everybody. They didn't want to put everybody in jail permanently like a Guantanamo. These are not options that the Chinese exercise. They did another thing, bring people in, put them in these places and hold seminars or whatever. Now, you can have a criticism of that, but is that genocide? I don't think so. I mean, we also have to have a good, honest discussion about what is a genocide. I mean, what's happening in Palestine is a genocide. 50, 60,000 people dead. Nobody has made number claims like that for Xinjiang. You know, 300 disappeared. What, this is meaningless, frankly. It's not serious, you know. It's not a serious criticism of the situation in China. You know, what do people want? They want to make a whole bunch of Israels around the world, only Uyghur province in Xinjiang, and only Kashmir, for only Kashmiris, that's Israel. You want to make a million Israels? Not my politics. I want to live in a plurinational society. I want to work to build rights for everybody. You know, if people in Australia believe so much in that, you know, Han colonization, so-called, has to end in China, well, then let them all go home to England and wherever they came from and give the land back to the Aboriginal people.
Yeah, I mean, here especially, I spoke to one professor that spent his whole life, Professor Jerry Georgiadis, spent his whole life researching a lot of things, but especially Indigenous suicide rates, and that 40% of the Indigenous population here are, especially in the state of WA, are below the poverty line, and 100% of suicides come from that. So there are deep, it's, you know, one thing, yeah, of course, addressing the historical ills, which aren't that far, that would be your generation for the stolen generation, but it's the continuing youth detention. I mean, in the Northern Territory, they just dropped the age to 10. The carceral age is now 10 years old.
So, I mean, that's crazy, you know. I mean, you tell me that you'd put a 10-year-old kid in jail and just sort of throw away the key, you know, and say that that is not a genocidal situation, you know, where there's been an active attempt to erase the Aboriginal people. That is not a genocidal situation. But what's genocidal is having to deal with a group that has been actually killing people for a project which nobody believes in. I'm against armed violence unless there is some massive sentiment and massive repression. You know, where is the attempt to build a politics in that region? You know, now in Xinjiang, You know, the standard of living has risen as a consequence of the abolition of absolute poverty. It's not paradise. Nowhere is paradise. But it's certainly not the same as Israeli bombs falling on 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza.
Well, something that strikes me about this is this rolling out of the term genocide seems almost, I don't know, like an institutional tool. Because really you spend more time defining what is and what isn't, what qualifies, when really there's killing happening on the ground and that's all that should matter. And all these other sort of talks of semantics kind of distract from the real issues, which is, if you, like you just said, if you just interact with the issue, you'd probably find out more than what you want to know or whatever.
And there's a UN convention against genocide. Just read the text. You don't need to debate what is or isn't. Read the text, see if a certain reality fits with the text. The problem is people cherry pick these texts. It talks about an attack on culture, but an attack on culture is not sufficient to raise it to the level of genocide. You know, look, culture has changed always and has mutated always. You know, was the introduction of English by the British in India a genocide, cultural genocide? I don't think so. You know, our cultural traditions are intact. Most of us added English to our language. We have all these other languages and English. Is it a cultural genocide? I think that's going too far. You know, that's also claiming too much for the natural process in human history of violence and the establishment of new cultures. You know, there's a lot of violence in the world. All violence isn't genocide.
And this thought of, like, especially within the left, of creating these sorts of, I don't know, ideological monoliths in your head that you have to debate and, you know, scratch your chin about, and rather than do actual action. It struck me yesterday in your talk that you said Marxism is a process, is an action, it's an action thing, it's not a perfect formula, and that there's a legitimate critique to be within the revolution, within doing something better, not outside of it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're committed to building something, you will learn new habits. You know, people who fight to build things build habits of patience as well, you know, and care and concern. People have different skills. How do you amalgamate people into a project and so on? It teaches you a lot to be involved. When you're not involved, and then you're basically sitting at a computer and firing off, you know, your insults at people, it's much easier to be impatient. You know, patience is something that is learned. It's learned through struggle. And revolutionary patience is a very high ethic for people of the left.